Welcome to Season 2 of Fintechs A, a podcast by the one and only Policy Shop for Canada's fintech scene. I'm Alex, and I'll be your host. Join me as I talk to the people who are making a big difference in the lives of Canadians. Today's episode is all things competition law with Keldon Bester. Keldon is the Executive Director of the Canadian Anti-Monopoly Project, or CAMP for short. Hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, you run CAMP, not CAMP the American folk band, but a different kind of CAMP. Who are you guys?
Yeah, not a folk band, certainly. So CAMP is a Canadian think tank focused on really what we see as a monopoly problem in Canada. But I think on a more positive side is this vision that we have of, you know, a more democratic economy. So, you know, we're folks that come from different parts of Canada's anti-monopoly movement and who identify a gap in the policy discussion in Canada that we think really needs to be built out. So, you know, what are we doing? We're reading, we're writing, we're researching and coming up with solutions for, you know, what we see as a pretty pressing economic problem.
Why does Canada need a CAMP?
Why does Canada need a CAMP? Well, you know, there's 2 airlines, 5 banks, 3.5 telecoms, you know, 2 railroads. You know, Canada needs a CAMP like the U.S. needs and has a CAMP, like Europe needs and has a CAMP. You know, we have a system that generates concentrations of economic power, and it's a job of democracies to balance that. So I think, you know, Canada needs a CAMP for these sort of foundational reasons. And I think we need it even more today because we've got a pretty pressing set of economic problems that I think sort of the CAMP prescription is part of the answer.
Quick tangent I just have to embark on here. Few players in all these industries is a common theme in that answer about concentration of economic power. What about the concentration of political power? We have, you know, depending on who you ask, two to three choices between parties. And you said your goal is to democratize the Canadian economy. If this is good for our more political system, why isn't it good for our economic system?
Well, you know, if you look to compare us to the U.S., I guess we've got a pretty low concentration level of our political parties. No, I mean, I think that let's look at the past year, calendar year. You know, when do we get the best results out of our political system is when parties are in contention and fighting for, you know, literally the votes of Canadians, but also, you know, the support and confidence. So I think I would look at the last year. You know, certainly not been a great year on a number of fronts, but here we have every party in Canada responding to the challenges that Canadians are facing. And so I think that logic applies just as well. We can have the same issues when political parties become, you know, a bit ossified and stuck in their ways. And I think we've seen that play out in a number of generations in Canada.
In an ideal world, what would our antitrust regime look like?
You know, I don't know what the ideal antitrust regime looks like, but I think we take a step back. It's like, what does the ideal economy look like? It's where Canadians, in whatever way they interact with the economy, whether as, you know, consumers, as workers, or as entrepreneurs, feel like they're getting a fair deal, feeling like they have autonomy and freedom, you know, that they're not locked into, whether it's a, you know, restrictive employment contract or, you know, stuck with only one supplier for trying to run a business. So, you know, we're working on and developing sort of the policies that enable that. But I think what's more important is that big vision of freedom in the economy, no matter how you interact with it.
You guys are pretty new, but I've seen you in front of committees, on TV, in the press. You guys seem everywhere. Much bigger organizations with longer histories have less to show for it than you guys do. What's your secret? How do you do this?
Well, I'll take the compliment. You know, I think there's two things, and three, if we're being real. I think there's, you know, maybe there's a Canadian answer, an American answer, but I'll give you the Canadian one, which is, you know, we have a very specific focus. We have a focus on something that we think is under-addressed in the sort of policy discussion. And we're having a moment, not just in Canada, but in the US and Europe and globally, where we're reckoning with the power that we've allowed to accumulate in different parts of our economies. So I think those three things together, you know, two which are in our control and another which is external, means that we've been able to have an outsized impact on the policy conversation.
Who were the competition reform voices in Canada before you guys were founded?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, the reform conversation in Canada is both old and young. But I think, you know, voices like, you know, VASP, Bednar, organizations like Open Media focused on internet issues and the Public Interest Advocacy Center, you've had folks taking slices of the competition and monopoly conversation. But what Canada hasn't had to date is a, you know, unified focus on, you know, competition and monopoly as a as an issue. And frankly, you had organizations who were focused on the topic, but were firmly in the camp of everything's fine and there's nothing to see here. So what we're dealing with is a pretty insular community. And that's not unique to Canada, but the competition in antitrust space over the past couple of years has had to deal with an opening up of the conversation to more regular folks who aren't economists, who aren't lawyers. And that's a real pressure test for the ideas and the you know, structures that have really shaped the conversation to date.
Not just economists, not just lawyers. I want to probe you on that so badly, but we'll do it later in the conversation. In every good story, every hero needs a villain and vice versa. If Camp is one in the Canadian story that's being written and told, who's the other?
Who's the villain?
Well, whether you guys are the hero or the villain, it depends on one's priors. So if you're one of them, who's the other?
I mean, the opposition is the concentrated sources of power that benefit from the current arrangement and the people who sort of support that firmament, right? But I think something we want to get away with is this idea of, like, you know, good and bad company, right? I get asked sometimes, you know, what's a bad company? What makes a bad company? And it's like asking in some ways, like, you know, what's a bad planet? Right? Like if you're big enough to have gravity and to shape the world around you, we need to take that seriously.
I mean, so, it sounds like Pluto may have been a bad planet. I mean, it got degraded in status,
yeah,
right?
Pluto got what was coming to it. So, you know, leave that for the astronomers. But I think that's an important point, right? Is, you know, we have firms that engage in, you know, problematic conduct, deceptive marketing, all that good stuff, clean cut things. But what we need to get a better handle on is the relationship between these organizations, whether they are sort of, you know, under some normative framework, good or bad. We need to look at what the outcomes for Canadians are and for our economy.
You guys have Tim Wu on your advisory board, which is pretty cool, regardless of whether or not you agree with Tim Wu on all the things he talks about and writes about. How'd you get him on your advisory board?
Well, you know, Tim Wu, like many folks, is a secret Canadian. So we really played the maple leaf angle there. But Tim is somebody who cares very deeply about this, you know, not just within the bounds of the U.S. where he's, you know, lived and worked for so many years, but as a, you know, framework for how to structure, you know, just society in so many words. So, you know, Tim was very generous and is a big, you know, intellectual and political guiding light for us. And so we really benefit from his perspective.
Are there any similar groups around the world that you guys look to for inspiration or model yourselves on?
100%. You know, specifically in the U.S., we have open markets started by Barry Lynn and the American Economic Liberties Project, started by Sarah Miller. You know, two really foundational organizations that got this conversation started in the U.S. and have been at this for quite a while and do really phenomenal work. You know, looking abroad, places like Europe, we have organizations like the Balanced Economy Project, SOMO. You know, these are similar organizations that, you know, take different cuts at this problem, but that CAMP really, you know, learns a lot from every day and aims to model ourselves after.
I'm reluctant to turn this into the equivalent of a book on intellectual history, but only a little. So please tell me about the intellectual history behind this movement, which sounds like it, you know, goes beyond Canada. It's global, but which is materializing in Canada as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if you really want to get to the root of it, depending on who you ask, you go back to some 18th century British law, the first one to regulate monopoly, although Canada tries to claim that we had an early one. But it really is a kind of, you know, Western and North American tradition, most famous in the U.S., but not limited to the U.S., but an understanding of a need to balance the power of, at the time, emerging and fairly new concentrations of power. So, you know, you could say it's Jeffersonian, say it's Brandeisian, but the reality is that there's a pretty rich intellectual history, particularly in the United States, of wrestling with this question of, you know, what is the right approach to engaging with and, you know, tackling this persistent problem. So when I think about, you know, my own intellectual, you know, people that I look to, I think to more contemporary folks, Barry Lynn, Lena Khan, you know, Matt Stoller, Sandeep Vahisan. These are some of these lights, both, you know, none of them are particularly academic, although some of them are, but they're pulling from a pretty deep tradition that I think is bigger than an individual. Although in the antitrust space, you think about everybody throws out the name Bork, everybody throws out the name Brandeis. You know, there is a tendency to kind of stick this all on one person, but I think the tradition is much richer. And in Canada, let's be frank, we've really coasted on the U.S. And in some ways, we continue to do that today. But in Canada, we've taken a back seat, and that reflects in our law, especially over the past, you know, 50 years. And we can get more of that later.
What's been the big difference between the Canadian and U.S. approaches to antitrust over the past 50 years or 100 years?
I think the biggest difference at the foundational level is a greater skepticism of concentrated power in the U.S. And that, I think, goes back to the founding of the two countries. We can talk about, you know, the American Revolution against the British, whereas the Canadian sort of colonial development. And, you know, there's a professor out of Waterloo, Horatio Morgan, who I've been reading lately, and you know, talking about how those different institutions set us on different paths. But I think at a political cultural level, Canada for a long time has thought more about a partnership between concentrated economic power. And the U.S. has engaged in that and explored that and made use of that in the past. But for a long time, you know, up until about the 70s or 80s, when the tide started to turn, there was a much greater skepticism and fear that this was a threat to their democracy.
What do you think it was about Canada that motivated it to take this different approach, embrace this different philosophy?
You know, there's a lot of reasons. I think one is, again, going back to that colonial foundation, going to our proximity to the U.S., going to our real reliance on the development of natural resources and the lower parts of the value chain globally, particularly at the start, you know, going back to, you know, staple theory, all that good stuff. you know, we have been a little more inward looking and thinking about putting up barriers around Canada, I think, throughout our history. I think like the National Economic Program or policy, I can't remember the right phrase. And so that inward focus and thinking of how we engage with the rest of the world has been very different. And I think that shapes what a lot of policy areas, but certainly our competition policy.
What I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm totally mischaracterizing what you're saying. What I'm hearing is it's a kind of pathetic cowardice. It's like a loss aversion. It's like, I have so little, I'm afraid to lose even more. So I'm just going to build this big wall around what I got and have my biggest players here work together to stand up that wall.
I think there's a bit of a us versus the world approach to this, right? You know, our competition law in the 80s was in a big way premised on this idea that if we let our hometown heroes consolidate, that they would go forth and participate globally and sort of bring the spoils home. But for a variety of reasons, I think that thesis has been disproved. And we've created a situation where we sort of fence off parts of our economy to allow those parts of the economy to kind of harvest the domestic economy. I don't know if I'm not about to go solo. I'm not that much of a doomer to say, you know, pathetic cowardice, but it is something about core to, I think, a Canadian mindset, which is about thinking we've got a good thing going here and holding on to that.
You mentioned Lina Khan earlier. Is there a Canadian equivalent of Lina Khan, either established or up and coming?
No, I don't think so, and I don't know if we should if that should be the goal. I mean, you know, Lina is a really a phenomenal individual, a phenomenal thinker, and a real guiding light, especially with her work as chair of the Federal Trade Commission. But I think in Canada, we need to think more about a broad-based approach to this, and that is what's happening in the U.S. You know, there's a whole universe of people doing the work and making the change, and Lina is an excellent sort of figurehead or guiding light. But I think in Canada, what we need is not to have a superstar, but to have a general shift in how everyday people approach these issues. We can have the current commissioner of competition, Matthew Boswell. You know, he gets called a cowboy commissioner, mostly because he's just doing his job. The environment is very pro status quo, and so even small changes to that cause quite a big ruckus. But we have some groundwork to do to change how Canadians think about economic power before we worry about having a Lina Khan.
Critics of Lina, and I mean to some extent critics of Matt Boswell too, suggest she can be dogmatic, too quick to bring a case against the tech titan, even if the case has shaky legal underpinnings. Supporters say, but this is what a competition enforcer ought to be doing, using all its might to challenge any non-trivial probability of market power. In all of this, though, when I take all this in, the line between what's effective and what is ineffective isn't always clear to me. So my question to you is, does a good competition enforcer choose to err on the side of a false positive or a false negative?
You know, it's a good question. I think the kind of error cost framework has been abused in the competition space. And so I generally avoid it, but I'll answer the question. You know, the reality is that the scope of the work for a competition enforcer is is quite narrow. And so even within that narrow space, you need to think about, am I pushing on the boundary? And what is the value of pushing on that boundary, right? You know, there's a good argument to be made to say, well, they should, actually, I take it back. There's a bad argument to be made, which is to say we should only take cases that we win. Well, I think that's what we had in Canada. And that's why we had, you know, our last litigated abuse of dominance case was over like airplane food and the contracts for those, you know, not exactly the most critical market to our economy. You know, why do we have merger challenges that focus, you know, on waste management for oil and gas services? You know, those are important, but are we solving for cases that we can win as opposed to cases that we should be taking? So when folks look at the win-loss rate for the FTC and the DOJ, which is actually much better than some people allude, particularly when you look at abandonments and mergers, we need to be pushing that boundary because that's where we focus not on winning in terms of like numbers on the board, but in terms of challenging things that can really harm, in their case, Americans, in our case, Canadians, and globally, you know, citizens around the world. So, you know, the merits of an individual case are, you know, to be argued in front of courts, but I would much rather have an enforcer taking a swing at something that is problematic than sitting it out. Because to return to the error cost framework, you know, particularly for mergers, I'll focus on mergers because I think the point needs to be made. If you miss on a merger, if you say this looks like it might be problematic, but I'm going to let it go, then it's over. You know, in Canada, we really functionally have no ability to reverse mergers. So when we have this one-way street, I think we really benefit from being much more cautious than thinking that we're cavalier because we challenge one or two of these mergers. If you challenge a merger and it's defeated, you know, those parties can come back. They can put together a different transaction, you know, unlikely to do so, but it's still possible. But if we miss a harmful merger, especially in Canada, we're toast. And we've been extremely lax for the past much longer than 50 years. And now we're dealing with the consequences.
I've heard a few criticisms of a more aggressive enforcement culture. Some admittedly seem a bit like stretches. Some give me pause and make me think. I've heard, for example, that a more aggressive enforcement culture that's more permissive of false positives could cause businesses at the margin to operate in strange ways. Maybe they shy away from shared infrastructure projects. Maybe they don't merge when they should because, let's just say hypothetically, merging wouldn't result in less competition, but would result in greater economies of scale and scope. Or maybe firms decide to invest more at the margin in legal and compliance and less at the margin in R&D. Why isn't this something we should be worried about?
Well, you know, I think it's that phrase at the margin is important here, right? So if we look at the past, you know, 5-10 years, let's talk about mergers specifically. The Bureau looks at, and I mean the absolute lowest level of involvement at maybe something like less than 8% of mergers. And they actually intervene in something much less than 1% of all merger activity. And when we think about the focus of our merger law, it's really on a very specific slice of merger and acquisition activity. So if we are deterring activity in that part of on these edge cases, I see that as a positive, right? Let alone what percentage of there'd be no way to even know what percentage of sort of business conduct the Bureau is looking at, joint ventures, something like that. It would be infinitesimal. I don't even know how to measure it. But because of the focus of our law, the deterrent factor, I think, is actually a positive. And the more we shape our law to focus on deterring acquisition by already dominant firms, I think the more we say to those firms, if you want to grow, then you need to grow organically by competing for customers, competing for business, rather than sort of the paper entrepreneurialism of buying up everybody around you. So I think at the margin, you could say, you know, folks will have to think more about what mergers they're pursuing. But we're talking about a very small subset, and we're talking about a subset that we actually do want to deter.
Another thing I've heard, and this is an interesting criticism because it seems, it just seems kind of an odd one to make. It's that a more aggressive enforcement philosophy will just be ineffective. I've heard this argument made in the U.S. a few times. Consider a world where antitrust enforcement is long and drawn out, and by the time cases are brought and closed, the cycle of creative destruction has its way with the market power anyway. For example, I've heard the argument that Standard Oil was already starting to face new competition and lose market share before the government broke it up. So the TLDR, I think, is we're throwing resources at an issue that in some number of cases will resolve itself while creating a bunch of other unintended consequences at the margin. Why shouldn't we be worried about how effective antitrust enforcement is at the outset?
Well, I think we should be very worried about how effective antitrust enforcement is. And I think there is a lot of real constraints, and a couple of which you just mentioned, that impact how effective antitrust can be in protecting competition in our economy. But my response to that is not, well, why don't we save a couple million bucks a year? It's how do we create a system, including and beyond antitrust, that actually gets us the outcomes that we're after. So if you think about, well, you know, this issue might have resolved itself in a couple of years, you know, there's a couple of things to talk about. And I won't speak specifically to Standard Oil, but just think about it in general. Think about, well, oh, for one, that's not a guarantee. Two, the size of that impact, that economic consequence, can be massive. And three is that antitrust is pretty cost effective, right? So if we think about one of the most expensive and most recent, you know, merger challenges to date, I think, you know, Rogers Shaw, you know, tens of millions of dollars are spent on this legal defense. But if that defense has a, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% impact on an outcome in a market that's Canadian wide, you know, the figures are pretty astronomical. You think about a very important competition law case, again, Toronto Real Estate Board, the ability of sites like Redfin to get data about real estate. You know, if that had any impact on pricing and quality outcomes in the real estate market, that's billions of dollars a year, I think, very quickly. So, you know, if somebody says this takes too long, we don't do enough of this, I say, well, let's do it faster, let's do more.
The only other thing I've heard every now and again, and this is more in the Canadian context, and it seems like a criticism that's kind of grasping at straws, but I mean, here it is in any event. It's less a criticism, it's actually more just like dampening enthusiasm about antitrust reform rather than directly criticizing it and saying it's not, you know, it's not a good thing. And it goes something like this. Most market power problems are the result of government protectionism and regulatory barriers to entry. And so rather than focusing so much time and effort on better equipping the Bureau, we should direct our attention to opening up markets. Why shouldn't we be worried that we're using the wrong tool for the job that's actually before us?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, you know, you can walk and chew gum right? And you want to go somewhere and you also want to enjoy the many benefits of gum. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's unreasonable to say this slices and dices and is going to solve all of our problems, right? We have things to look at on multiple fronts. And it would be unwise to just load everything onto, you know, a 400 person agency and say, all right, get cracking. But it's a pretty unique tool that we've created, which can go deep, much deeper than actually even some federal regulators, into markets and uncover, understand, and address competitive issues, right? And so, you know, there are certainly regulatory barriers to competition. You know, you look at the US and what the work they were doing around the availability of things like hearing aids and, you know, asthma inhalers. I mean, that was a patent issue. But, well, and that's a good example, right? So there's the hearing aid example, which is the government regulation piece. They change that, make them over the counter, prices come down. But, you know, you have real issues. You know, we talk about, go back to the first, where the iconic example in the competition space is the railroad, right? We're not going to get another railroad in Canada, but that's a big part of our economy and something that we rely on in a number of ways. We need to think about how we handle that economic power. And the answer, we can't just solve it by saying, well, why don't we get government out of the way? If we got government out of the way and you think of like the telecom space, it would still be a multi-billion-dollar question of owning and operating a telecommunications network. I don't really see the through line on how things get better there. In fact, I think they get worse. So I don't want to throw that baby out with the bathwater and say, no, if we just give the Competition Bureau $200 million, all our problems will be solved. But I think we need to move beyond this kind of competition or regulation dichotomy.
I think you did a great job of showing all that goes into thinking about market power, whether it exists in the first place, whether it's a problem, how it can be a problem, how it can take shape, how it might even be inevitable in certain cases, in the absence of a kind of strong government hand to say, no, you will not conduct yourself in that way or collaborate in that way. One of the more important things we do at the outset of an analysis like this is to define the relevant market and figure out whether there is an excess of market power. I often wonder about how the limits of our knowledge challenge our ability to do this. Quite frankly, I'm often curious about how the limits of our knowledge challenge us to do like pretty much anything, even simple things we take for granted. I'm not questioning how smart our regulators are. They're obviously very smart. But how do they really know what the relevant market is and whether there's an excess of market power in a given case?
I think this is a great point and one that goes to a foundational element of how we approach this law in other areas, right? Antitrust and competition law is insanely guilty of becoming a highly technical, highly crystal ball gazing exercise that makes economists and lawyers a lot of money. But and at the end of the day, we don't know if it's a particularly accurate reflection of, you know, market realities. So this is something we've been in front of committee talking about recently, is what we need to shift the focus on is less who can create the most accurate model of what the future of this market might be, and more so to, you know, what are the presumptions? What are the guardrails? What are the, you know, frankly, biases that we need to encode into our law to create the conditions for success in the future? Because we've talked a lot about government and government regulation and government intervention, but let's focus that competition law is about preserving and protecting competition. Like, it's fundamentally pro-commerce and about maintaining and establishing vibrant markets that we probably can't predict particularly accurately. So right now we're in this sort of hubristic position that if we do enough math, we'll get to the right answer. When you know, what we argue for is an approach that is much more about, you know, what is the most likely path to, you know, a prosperous and dynamic economy, and let's set up rules that put us on that path, as opposed to comparing, you know, price increases versus welfare decreases versus efficiency gains versus this, that, and the other thing. Because, you know, we talk about regulatory humility, and that usually means just don't do anything. But I think what we need to focus on is much more the process that we're trying to protect versus the Excel spreadsheet that we are, you know, submitting to a judge at the end of an antitrust case.
Isn't there, though, a sort of circularity or question begging to presumptions? Like, you know, this is anti-competitive because it looks a certain way. Why is that anti-competitive? Well, because it looks a certain way. Like,
two things. One is something looks a certain way. You know, there's some things that we know the look of that we don't like. You know, deceiving customers, colluding on.
I love when my firms lie to me.
Sorry?
No, I'm joking. I love when my businesses lie to me. No, I don't.
Think about that. Like, we understand things as fair and unfair in certain circumstances, right? We say this is not beneficial. We don't need a calculation to tell us that lying to your customers is bad. You know, we get into deeper waters and have to do more thinking when we think about something like exclusivity arrangements or tying or non-competes or this, that, and the other thing, right? So it's not just that they look a certain way. It's one is that we have evidence of the consequences of this conduct, and we make a, you know, normative call on what we want our economy to look like. You know, do we want our economy to be one in which all suppliers are locked into a dominant buyer? I mean, on the one hand, you can say, well, maybe we get some cost savings there. Maybe we don't. On the other hand, we get a much more, ossified is a bit much, but a much clunkier economy and a situation where it's much harder for newcomers to offer a competitive challenge. So, you know, it's not I know it when I see it, but it's about, you know, taking evidence and creating presumptions based on that evidence to guide the future of our enforcement beyond just saying, well, everything might be fine. Let's do a bunch of math beforehand.
Yeah. In certain cases, it seems pretty black and white to me, like in the cases of lying to your customers. But in cases where, like, what we're trying to figure out is, does this firm have enough power to influence prices in the market? Like, I'm not sure how you actually get to the bottom of that ex ante.
There's a variety of ways. I mean, ex ante, you're setting up, you're not saying this is the wrong level of profit. You're not saying that this price is too high, but you're looking at it and you're saying, you know, what is used to maintain and increase that price, that power, that quality level, that market condition. So, you know, we use these signals, we use these indicators, concentration rising, few players in a market, prices that seem very consistent and higher than either international peers or in other areas of the country where the market structure is different. We're pulling together these indicators and seeing whether they point us in the right direction of conduct that is holding back, you know, competition. And it gets to real questions, right? We talked about the Toronto Real Estate Board. There's a real question about what does the right of someone who sort of collects or sits on a source of data or an asset or a bottleneck to exploit that bottleneck, right? That's a thick question that we need to deal with. And antitrust is just one way that we deal with it.
I'm guilty of using the line that the big five banks control about 90% of the market, but I'm not actually sure how useful market concentration is. It sounds good, but like really, like what's the magic number in any given market? And there isn't this ironclad connection between market concentration on a national scale and the degree of actual competition in the more relevant local market. For example, like, you know, maybe we have big five banks that control 90% of the national market, but maybe there's a small town without internet. And, you know, for most residents, there's only this one lesser known bank branch that charges obscene rates and treats customers poorly. In that town, there's only one option. Then there's no competition, even though there are several choices in the broader market. So why shouldn't we be more skeptical of the market concentration stats that everyone, including myself, is throwing around?
Well, here's the reality is that today, although it's changing a little bit, is that when it comes to competition law, we're extremely skeptical of that. Right? We've really spent the past 40 years ignoring and trying our best to ignore the role of concentration. When in reality, is it a perfect measure? No, but it's a great and administrable foundation to our sort of stance or our lean towards where smoke might be coming from and whether or not there's fire. So you're 100% correct, is that, you know, that doesn't give us the, we don't get a magic number, right? You know, some people advocate, you know, Barry Lynn in particular, rule of four. You want at least four suppliers in whatever relevant market to ensure that they can be played off one another. But what do we know and what has held up quite well is, you know, when your number of players in the relevant market and your point about the local and then versus the national, where do you actually move? Where do you actually transact? Where do you, you know, buy your groceries? Where do you rent a home? Where do you work? That really comes down to a much more narrow place. But when there are fewer players, it's easier for companies to get cozy with one another. There's fewer options for consumers or other businesses. And so accordingly, it's not a perfect measure. We don't have perfect information and we need a system that's administrable. So it's a great guide for, if we're going to spend these precious enforcement resources, let's focus it on the areas where it's most likely that issues are occurring. Keeping in mind, you think about deceptive marketing or even other examples, is that, you know, smaller firms and firms that maybe don't make the headlines are capable of engaging in conduct that we also find problematic. And we're creating a set of guardrails for our economy. And you think about, in Canada, we have abusive dominance. That's a test for conduct that harms competition. And one of the tests is, are you dominant? Now, the reason we have that is because we understand this is a proxy for your ability to influence a market. Going back to that planet example, your gravity. So despite concentration not being the, you know, be all end all, it's a great guidepost for, you know, preserving what competition we have and promoting it going forward.
Some competition reformers want antitrust enforcement to go beyond promoting economic competition. Antitrust should have other goals in their view, like fighting inequality or protecting jobs or, you know, doing a wide variety of things. Is that a good or bad idea from your perspective and why?
I think we need a strong set of competition laws that are focused on protecting competition. What we have engaged in the past 40 years in Canada is we said competition is okay, but there are other things that we care about more. In particular, this notion of efficiency. So we were willing to trade off competition for these alleged efficiency gains because we weren't all that confident in whether competition was actually that good. And what I think we really want to push on is an investment in competition as a good, competition as something that delivers a range of benefits. And I think inherently there's a bit of a narrowness to that. But as soon as something becomes a dimension of competition, we need to deal with that. And I think one example is, you know, as consumers make decisions based on the environmental impact of the firms that they interact with, you know, they want to be, you know, eco-conscious consumers. That means that there ends up being a dimensionality between competition and environmental protection, but competition law stays relatively constrained within what matters to competition. And a similar conversation in the privacy space. So competition law authorities can't avoid these questions, but I think we need to keep it really anchored in a belief that competition is what we're fighting for.
One thing that has stood out to me is that there's a lot of complexity and nuance here, like when we're trying to figure out whether some kind of market behavior is good or bad. Do you think the nature of the problem is at odds with this want to have a broader range of stakeholders as part of the conversation, rather than confining it to backroom talks and analyses between wonks, economists, and lawyers?
No, I think that's the kind of complexity that we shouldn't be shying away from. And you know, to the kind of earlier question, right? We need to think about what kind of complexity are we introducing, and does that paint a fuller picture or a narrower picture? So we can have extreme analytic complexity that actually narrows the focus and misses the reality of competition. And we can have complexity that actually considers the full range of impacts of conduct. So when we didn't look at, and we still haven't really, when we didn't look on the effects of labor, of mergers, they were still happening, but we waved them away. We said they'll find comparable jobs, and the monopsony power, you know, the ability to buy labor of a company really is not worth considering. But that didn't mean it didn't exist. We just didn't do the math. So when we think about complexity, I think we need to keep in mind whether it's a complexity that narrows or a complexity that actually grapples with the reality of the conduct we're focused on.
Slight tangent, but the question just popped into my head. Speaking of complexity, there was a paper I read a while ago by Carl Shapiro, and he was obviously talking about the U.S., not Canada. But I think after assessing the state of affairs, he recommended a few things, all of which was to strengthen antitrust enforcement. But he focused on three areas in particular. I think it was better merger control. Authorities need to get better at cracking down on exclusionary conduct by firms. There was one more. It's escaping me now. I wish I had thought of asking you this. There was one more. Damn. This is the preface to my question. My question is, you know, if you were to do a similar kind of assessment in Canada, like what are some of the areas that competition authorities are not paying enough attention to?
You know, Canada is a country of oligopolies. I think in relatively rare situations, although they certainly exist, and we've created them, we've allowed them to be created, do we have, you know, the literal definition of monopolies? You know, like the nerd definition. But what Canada needs to take quite seriously, I think, is the prevalence of very long-standing oligopolies across the economy nationally and locally, and our, I shouldn't say inability, but the relatively reduced role of newcomers and new entrants to these really important markets, right? You know, it's a fun stat, and I think it was Bass Bednar and Graham Moffat that put it together. But you think about the average age of the top 20 companies in the TSX is 150 years. Compare that to the S&P, it's something like 20. getting it wrong, but the point stands, right? So we really need to focus on the much tougher question, which is beyond how do we stop oligopolies from forming, what do we do with them once they are formed? And how do we create a situation where we don't just regulate them within an inch of our lives, but we also take seriously the potential to break those up? I mean, both break up in like the antitrust sense, but in a much more relevant way, I think, as well, as to actually get new blood in and really shake up markets that have become quite stagnant. So, you know, the Shapiro points are great, and I think about them in some ways as sort of a defensive and offensive. On the defensive side, we need to prevent further consolidation. We already have sky high concentration levels. We shouldn't be going further. If firms need to grow, then they need to figure out how to grow organically. But on the offensive side, it's thinking about, we have monopolies that are long standing, and how do we break that power open? And it's a much tougher question once you've allowed it to accumulate.
I think his third was, we need to focus more on labor. Monopsony need power.
Couldn't agree more.
I think that was the one. Yeah. Okay. So back to what we were saying before, sorry for the confusing sequence of questions. It's just, yeah, I'm all over the place sometimes. Back to bringing more voices into the debate. In my role, when something is too politicized, it makes me kind of squeamish. You lose a lot of control of something when it gets political. It becomes chaos. And perhaps this is an unpopular opinion, but when democracies politicize things, the things that democracies can want can be really, really dumb. The debate about the capital gains inclusion rate, I think, was good evidence of this. Regardless of what you think, I don't think any of us can deny that there were so many without opinions who didn't even appear to know what an inclusion rate was. The thinking on this from some of our best known economists was nuanced and thoughtful, whereas the thinking from some others was more self-interested, which is fine, if you ask me, or just uninformed, which is not fine. The latter is like pollution in a democracy. By getting more voices into the mix, by going beyond economists and lawyers, are we at risk of politicizing antitrust? And if we are, why is that a good thing?
You know, antitrust needs to be politicized, right? When we talk about building a democratic economy, we mean that, and we mean a commitment to democracy. When antitrust in Canada, or competition law, we really don't say antitrust, but it's a fun word to say, and Americans say antitrust, and I'm from Alberta, I can't do it. When Canadian competition law wasn't politicized, in the 80s, what was then called the Business Council on National Issues basically got to write the whole bill, and install the Commissioner of Competition that they wanted. And we had 40 years of, you know, basically unfettered consolidation. So when I think about depoliticized antitrust, I think about a lot of Canadians having to bear the weight of market power and monopoly power that they shouldn't have. So this politicization piece, it can cut in different directions. Now, to that point, right? We've been done right by the quote unquote politicization. We've been done wrong by it, and it depends what you want to call political. You know, Paul Martin's decision to prevent the big banks from merging in the 90s. That sounds pretty political to me, and that's probably one of the best things he did in his tenure. Huge, massive, can't be understated. Now, is that bad because it was political? You know, if the Competition Bureau at the time had come out and said, well, maybe if so-and-so sells off these ATMs and this credit card, and that wouldn't have been a political process, but the outcome could have been much worse. So, you know, we can't shy away from politics because it is a political issue. You know, the options that we have as consumers, as workers, as entrepreneurs, what we got when we quote-unquote offloaded that to apolitical actors was not particularly satisfying from my perspective.
In your view, if you were to map out the distribution of political outcomes, do they skew negative or skew positive?
It's tough because, first off, it's a relatively small sample, and the bank one is hard to beat in terms of if you're trying to put a dollar value on it, it's very difficult. But, you know, I think about, I look at the examples of airline mergers. There's a carve out for the Minister of Transport, similar to there being a carve out from the Minister of Finance for transportation mergers, the same as banking mergers. Whereas we can point to the 90s and say, look at this great decision, very wise, very correct. You know, we've had, it's got the opposite way where, you know, the Competition Bureau has said, you know, don't allow these airlines to merge. It will directly impact Canadians in a negative way. And the Minister of Transport says, thank you very much. And now I'm going to let them merge. And in one case, I think it was Air Transat, where I think that the European Union had to come in and say, actually, no, we're going to block it from our side. So again, we're trying to move away from this adding up points on either side of the scale. But I would much rather have a imperfect but democratically accountable antitrust or competition law than one that is totally sealed off from regular Canadians.
Back to banking. Glad you mentioned it. Camp and Fintechs Canada recently worked together on a joint letter to finance on how to promote competition in the financial sector. Why is Camp worried about competition in banking?
I think banking is, and not getting too hung up on the term, but the financial sector is really the foundation of our economy. There's a great quote from an old Supreme Court case in the U.S. looking at a bank out of Philadelphia saying, you know, concentration in banking is a recipe for concentration more generally. And I think that's true because, and I think the submission that we put together, or the report rather, does a great job of this, right? Is, you know, that we need a competitive and vibrant banking sector because it's the foundation of all these other sectors. You know, how does somebody start a new business? How does somebody grow that business? How does somebody try a new business model? That depends on access to finance. And there are many ways to do that. But I think if we have a financial sector that is consolidated, that is focused, you know, primarily on very low risk activities, where it's going to be difficult to create companies that change the game for Canadians and for people around the world.
Everyone in our corner, as you know, is always talking about open banking and payments modernization. But from your perspective, what's the most underrated idea to promote competition in banking? So, you know, the one that few, if any, are really talking about, but will have a big impact.
Underrated. You know, something that it's underrated, but it's a sticky one, is, you know, what is the process to becoming a bank or being able to operate like a bank in Canada? And we pride ourselves on a stable banking system, and rightly so. There should be a barrier. There needs to be a barrier. I agree with that. But we need to think about the actual process to being able to compete in this market if we want it to change. So open banking, again, great. Give consumers more control over their data. But if they have nowhere to really go with that data, then, you know, the competitive potential is dampened. So if I'm thinking about an underrated lever, it's also one of the trickier levers. And it's taken a hard look at, you know, what are the mandates of the institutions that determine who can and can't participate in these markets? And is there room to responsibly open that up to new players?
My bias for analytic complexity, I think, is showing. If it hasn't already shown, you know, through the conversation, but I wrote a blog post a while back trying to argue that there wasn't a competition problem in banking. I was just trying to be spicy, just trying to be a bit of a troll. I think I must have been bored at the time. I wanted, you know, people to be mad at me. If anyone is interested in reading it, reach out to me and I can send it over. Anyway, the upshot was just that by conventional measures of competition, Canadian banking doesn't seem bad. In fact, we're monopolistically competitive according to those conventional measures, which is normal for all markets. Perfect competition is a fiction. Why should we be convinced there's a competition and problem in banking if the econometric measures, the conventional ones, tell us otherwise?
Well, this is a good example of the limits of some of these indicators. On the one hand, you say we've got 5 and 6 if we want to be nice to the national bank. You know, 6 big players, and they're pretty evenly spread across the economy, you know, other than, you know, pretty rural and remote regions. But when you, you know, dig a little deeper, when you take a look at different dimensions, you start to get a different picture. And I point out to the work of the folks at North Economics, looking at the, you know, fees as well as the sort of value that Canadians get versus peers in places like the UK and Australia. We look at the profitability of Canadian banks, domestic businesses, sort of the what Canadian individual savers and borrowers interact with most frequently, and it's world-beating profit margins. And you know, you look at surveys, and Canadians are, you know, not really upset with their bank, but they're certainly not thrilled. You know, most people say, I'm with the same bank for my entire life, and I'm generally happy with it. But when you ask, well, you know, well, what about this dimension? Do you feel like you're getting value? When you start pulling it apart, there's questions to be asked. And I think a tougher one, and this is more qualitative, but, you know, you hear from entrepreneurs, people who have tried to start businesses in the past, that, you know, the bank's ability to take on new ideas and to fund new projects, they're much too conservative, and they're really just not interested in that business. It's much more profitable to, you know, lend out something very standardized, give somebody a mortgage who has a regular income. So I think you're right is when we say, look at the top line. You know, Canada's banking sector is not uniquely concentrated, but when we go a level deeper and look at international peers, there's a couple of things that are left wanting. And to belabor the topic, you know, we've kind of got an ongoing problem of these banks not exactly treating their customers with the respect we would understand. You know, multiple investigations, folks at CBC Marketplace uncovering pretty problematic conduct. So I think those things point to say that there's much more work to be done.
Last question. If I want to help Camp, how do I do it?
You know, we've got a donate button in the top right hand corner. I can't understate the value of that is, but I think much more importantly is taking this way of thinking, the idea that we deserve better as consumers, we deserve better as workers, we deserve better as entrepreneurs, and communicating that to people who are making these decisions and forming, you know, our municipal governments, our provincial governments, our federal governments, because it's going to take concerted action at each of those layers. And the average Canadian really doesn't have the time or the ability to, you know, fight monopoly all day. You know, we need our regulators, our policymakers, our politicians, our political thinkers, to participate in this process. And so I think a big piece is demanding more from all those areas.
Thank you, Keldon. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did.
Thanks so much.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks for joining us. If you're looking for more, visit us at fintechscanada.ca or follow us on LinkedIn. See you next time.